Man was walking down the road one day and he bumped into a friend he'd not seen for a bit, and he said, hello, how are you? And the chap said, well, matter of fact, he said, my wife died last week and went to heaven. And the man said, oh, I am sorry. And then thought that didn't sound right. So he said, I'm sorry, I mean, I am glad. And he thought that didn't sound right. So he said, I am surprised. And then he gave up. Well, I want to talk tonight about how you can die and go to heaven. I'm not going to spend any time on how you can die, because that'll happen whether we think about it or not. I want to spend all my time on how we can go to heaven, on what it is that makes me a Christian. Because if I don't think about that, I'll never arrive there. I know that to speak about that kind of a subject raises the hackles in some people who think that becoming a Christian is all an emotional experience. Well, I'd like you to turn up the reading that we had read to us a little earlier. If you've got one of the church Bibles, you'll find it's on page 84 of the second half of those Bibles. It's Luke chapter 23. You'll discover in this incident that feelings are running high. But they're not the feelings of being on cloud nine. They're not the great joy that David spoke about. There's no sense of relief or guilt or laughter or tears of remorse. And I've met all of those connected with true and spurious professions of faith. Now, the only tears we'll discover in this incident are tears of agony, because it's the story of a man who became a Christian as he hung dying on a cross. When he was converted, the only feelings he knew were pain. So what is it that led this man to Christ and to paradise? And the answer, of course, first of all, is the promise of God. And you'll see that in, I suppose, the punchline to this whole incident, verse 43. You remember the incident. There are these two thieves on either side of Jesus, and they're swearing and cursing, and then one of them rebukes the other, and finally he turns to Jesus. And in verse 43, in response to what he says, Jesus said to him, truly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. There's the promise of God, and it comes from Jesus, of course. He speaks with the utter confidence of the one who has authority to offer paradise, heaven, his kingdom, to a thief. Now, please, let's get it clear from the outset. I do have to view Jesus in that light. That's the way he spoke of himself. It is not the mark of a good teacher. Good teachers cannot make these promises. It's not the mark of a mighty prophet. Mighty prophets can't make these promises. It's only the mark of God's Messiah, God's anointed, appointed king. They are Jesus' dying words, and they're the fruit of his death. It may not be immediately evident from the little paragraph around there, but if you were to stop sometime and read the chapter as a whole, you would see it becomes crystal clear. There are two themes that run through this chapter. Both focus on Jesus. The first theme is this, that he's innocent and yet punished. Everyone is saying that he's innocent. If you're with us this morning, you won't be in the slightest bit surprised to discover that Pilate keeps on saying it. I find no crime in this man, he's already said once, and then in verse 14 he starts off again. You brought me this man as one who was perverting the people, and after examining him before you, behold, I didn't find this man guilty of any of your charges against him, nor did Herod. Verse 20, he addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus. A third time, verse 22, he said to them, why, what evil has he done? I found in him no crime deserving death. The criminal, as we shall see in a few minutes, he realized that Jesus was innocent. Look at verse 41. "This man," he says of Jesus, "has done nothing wrong." The centurion says it, verse 47. When the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God and said, "Certainly this man was innocent." Well, when a hard-bitten sergeant major speaks like that, you know that something's up, don't you? Joseph of Arimathea, verse 50, says it. "He was a member of the council, a good and righteous man, who had not consented to their purpose and deed, and he was looking for the kingdom of God." And it's crystal clear that if you were a good and righteous man, and you were looking for the kingdom of God, you would have said it too. He's innocent. Yes, he's innocent, and yet he's punished. And the second strand that runs through this chapter is that there is forgiveness from Jesus, although he's dying. He prayed for forgiveness, verse 34. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." He promised forgiveness, the verse we're looking at. "Truly, I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise." And it's symbolized in verse 45. The curtain of the temple is torn in two. The curtain was the bit strung across the temple, blocking off the Holy of Holies, the place where God symbolically was, from all the likes of you and me. Can you think of a more vivid way of describing that the gates of heaven, the gates to God himself, have been flung wide open than to say that this temple curtain was torn in two? And the moment that happens, Jesus dies. The job's done, all's over. Now, actually, when you've got those two things firmly embedded in your mind, you really don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to put two and two together. If Jesus suffers punishment for sins, yet is innocent, and I, a sinner, am offered forgiveness, isn't it clear that he is suffering for my sins? Luke doesn't go in for one-liners. But go and read through the chapter, and you couldn't have it expressed more vividly. As Peter, one of the other New Testament writers, puts it, "Christ died for our sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God." Yes, but as Jesus died, he died as he lived, amongst sinners, surrounded by them. One is believing, the other is unbelieving. Just as on the last day, he'll still stand as the dividing mark between men and women, between believers, believing men and women, and unbelieving men and women. These two thieves, these two criminals, are very close to him. And yet the difference between them couldn't be greater. I imagine that tonight most of us who are here are in some sense close to Christ. We've learnt much about him. We've had chance to discover things about him, whether it's from school or parents or that awkward friend called Blunderbuss or Tactful or whatever. Yet it's true that after death, the divisions between us could be huge. So why is this promise of God made to this one man and not the other? Well, here are the two marks of this criminal to whom Jesus speaks those astonishing words, "Truly, truly, today, with me in paradise." Here's the first of them. Firstly, he feared God. One of the criminals, verse 39, who were hanged, railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you're under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we're receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. He feared God. Now, as soon as I echo the thief's question, don't you fear God? I know that some will be leaping to conclusions. All those caricatures about the teachings of Catholic convents will be racing through people's mind. David will be immediately thinking of blunderbuss, and hellfire and damnation and dangling over the pit and so on will be coming into people's thoughts. Will you forget them? Now, I'm not saying there is no such thing as hell or judgment. Jesus spoke of them far too frequently for us to ignore them. This dying criminal is well aware that he's only a short breath away from God's judgment. But I don't want us to reduce the thought of fearing God to those kind of pictures. When the New Testament speaks of fearing God, it speaks of us treating God seriously, treating him properly, treating God as the one true living God he is. It did not drive his believers to abject terror. No, they were able to speak of God as Abba, Father. They were able to speak of themselves as his children. They were able to speak of their love for God and his love for them. They were able to speak of their joy and their hope of being with him. But fearing God did not mean that familiarity bred contempt either. Fearing God didn't mean to say that they domesticated him like some wild cat in a zoo. We must stop taming God. Reducing him to the old man in the skies complete with beard. Or the tame club mascot. It is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God as an unforgiven sinner. And this thief realized it. He started to fear God. And look what it did to him. It marked him off from the rest. Verse 40, the other rebuked him, saying, "Don't you fear God?" He's speaking to his fellow criminal, who spent the time swearing and cursing at Jesus. Not because he's some ogre, not because he's some extreme person. Please don't immediately put him in Madame Tussaud's Chamber of Horrors. No, he's just like all the rest of the crowd that day. That's all he's doing, copying them. Look at verse 35. The people stood by watching the execution, but the rulers, that is to say the religious leaders of the day, scoffed at Jesus, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he's the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him vinegar and saying, "If you're the king of the Jews, save yourself." And one of the criminals said, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." It's just like the crowd. They're all saying it. And if it's a prayer, then he's praying the way everyone prays self-centeredly. That's how the world prays, isn't it? When it comes to an emergency, you scream help to God. The most astonishing people shout help. Well, we heard how shocked David was to discover himself praying as he walked to church. He prays just how the world prays. You see, God becomes a servant whom you call upon in time of need. And if he doesn't do what you command, well, then so much the worse for God. It's one more sign that he doesn't really exist. I think back to my teenage years, and I think between the ages of 12 and 20, that I prayed a genuine, heartfelt prayer about 3 or 4 times. I'm not counting the ones I mouthed in church or chapel. Every one of them was an emergency. Get me off this punishment. Get me out of this mess. Well, this criminal in verse 39 is just the same, isn't he? And he's got rather more to be worried about than I had. I was in danger of being caned. He was in the process of being crucified. He's just like the rest of us. And no one likes to be different. Peer group pressure is immensely strong, isn't it? It's strong in us as teenagers, and we forget how much it clings to us as adults. I was looking through one of these books which speak of the situation around the world in religious terms, and I just looked up what's going on in Japan. There's a culture where it doesn't do to stand out from the crowd. And here's what this book says about specific weaknesses in the churches in Japan, the minority complex. Christians are a tiny minority in a society where consensus is important. Too few families have come to faith and individuals feel exposed. You don't have to be in Japan to sense that pressure, do you? And know that weakness. Or again, here's another weakness, the lack of bread-winning men in the churches. The drive for success and desire to satisfy the demands of employers make it hard for the menfolk to openly identify with and become active in a church. Women are in the great majority in most congregations. Well, you don't need to fly around to Japan to discover churches where that's true. And all of us, men and women, will know the pressure of satisfying the demands of employers and working as hard as the person on the next desk. And yet, this thief we're looking at here, this one to whom Jesus makes the astonishing promise, stands out from the crowd. That's what fearing God does for him. That, by the way, is the one way in which Christians are meant to be odd. I know there are lots of ways in which we seem odd. We can be incredibly religious at times. There can be the Christian Union type. We've probably all got our equivalent of David's story. I can remember just after I'd become a Christian at college, talking to an unbelieving friend about where I'd got digs, and he said, "Isn't so-and-so there?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Typical CU type, short hair, specs and spots." Well, it's all in the eye of the beholder, I suppose. When you become a Christian, people are paranoid that it'll mean they'll become odd. Well, you will, but there's only one way in which you need to become odd if you become a Christian. You'll start to fear God. Won't you treat him seriously? Will you fear God? The fear of God is the only power I know that'll break the fear of men. Here's the second thing that fearing God did for him. It not only made him stand out from the other, it meant that he saw himself for what he really was. Look on to verse 41. "Don't you fear God," he asked, "since you're under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we're receiving the due reward of our deeds." It's very rare for people to see themselves like this. I think of a small group of alcoholics who, when I was working up in Norwich, came to Christ. And in the very early days, when it was difficult to tell what was real and what was false, one of the striking marks about them was the way they talked of their past. They almost mocked the social workers there who, in trying to help them in the clinics, had tried to find excuses for them. Now they wrote off all those excuses. "Oh, we were guilty," they said. "It was our own fault. No messing, honest." It seemed a very clear evidence of God at work. You see, this thief is dying a God-forsaken death. For a Jew of his time, a death on a cross marked not only a place of execution, but a stigma of God's displeasure and God's judgment. And he's saying in verse 41, "I deserve it." It's not actually what people say, is it? Not today. We say, "How could God send me to hell?" The thief says, "God is entirely justified in sending me to hell."
Don't you fear God? He says to his mate.
Think of one young businessman I was speaking with earlier this week. And he's been exploring Christian things for a little while now. And I said to him, are you getting any nearer being able to act on anything? And he said, well, Hugh, it's a bit like this. Someone said to me that turning to Christ, it's a bit like stepping off a ship and into a lifeboat. And well, I think I'm getting there slowly, but you've got to believe the ship is sinking first before you'll step off, haven't you?
He's quite right.
And if I swan through life, presuming I'm free to pick and choose and live how I like, and there's no God that I'll need to treat any more seriously than some weak old fogey in the sky, I'll never see the ship is sinking. Won't you fear God? You'd think if the talk was about how to become a Christian, I would start by asking you, do you love God? But of course you never will unless you fear him first. Won't you treat God seriously? That's the start of becoming a Christian. David, we'll call him that, was a regular churchgoer. It's quite astonishing in view of what was to happen. His marriage had gone wrong. He had a sleep-in girlfriend, and one night as they were there talking together, for some strange reason she turned to him and she said, David, what do you think God thinks of us? He said to me afterwards he'd never thought about that question at all before. But he knew the answer. It was for him the first step on the road to Christian life. Don't you fear God? This thief did. And Jesus said to him, today, with me, in paradise. Secondly, this thief trusted Jesus. Verse 42. And he said, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingly power. It's extraordinary insight to recognize Jesus for who he was. The criminal could see only a broken, dying man. But he spoke of a resurrected king. Now let me just pause for a moment to make this point, that when Luke here speaks of criminals, or at least when our translation speaks of criminals, it's not some common or garden thief that's being spoken of. Please put out of your minds the idea of the man in the striped jumper with the bag marked swag over his back, sloping off in the dark. The word is a rather strange one. It means bandit. It's a peculiar word, and there's some good reason for thinking that it was given to a special group. It was speaking of those who at the time would be fighting for the hope of the kingdom of Israel. A good translation, I guess, might well be to speak of them as revolutionaries. It's got many of the connotations of that word. There was something political about what they were doing. They wanted to establish a free Israel nation again. There was something violent about many of them. They might well have been labeled terrorists today. Yes, they were criminal, but there's an idealism linked up with it. If it was robbery that he was executed for, it would have been robbery for the cause. And there would have been religious overtones. I suppose something a little akin to the IRA, the UDF in Ireland. There was a God dimension to it. Yes, there can be, can't there? We know it, we experience it, we see it on our television screens. There is a perverted religious idealism. It's highly likely this man was bound up in that. And it's this broken, disillusioned, criminal idealist who in his dying moments turns to see Jesus. And I suspect it's partly because of that background that he's able to see him for who and what he is. And if that's the case, then Luke is speaking to the idealist in all of us and focuses us on Jesus. What kind of person do you long to be? He's the one. What kind of life do you want to lead? What kind of cause do you want to fight? Well, he's the one worth serving and giving your life to. What kind of world do you want to see? His is the kingdom to be part of. Well, what kind of hope have I got of getting there? Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingly power. Chips McCurry was a Protestant paramilitary. He'd been convicted of murder and was locked in the Mays prison. And about 10 years ago, just under that, a lady called Gladys Blackburn entered his cell on Christmas Eve. Chips recognized her. He'd often seen her in the prison and knew, like most of the other inmates, that if you don't want to hear the gospel, then you'd better run when you see Miss Blackburn coming. She was in her mid-60s and a retired school teacher and a prison visitor. I've got a picture of a kind of missionary Miss Marples in my mind. But there was nowhere to run, and Miss Blackburn took the chair at the small desk directly opposite Chip's cot and asked if she could read some scriptures. Chips prepared himself for a recitation of the Christmas story, but instead Miss Blackburn opened her Bible to Luke 23, the account of the crucifixion. She stopped when she came to the words of the thief on the cross, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Now, who was this thief calling Lord? Miss Blackburn asked Chips, her pale blue eyes looking intently into his. Don't you admire the way that people like this can take on these murderers with absolutely no fear and just ask them the straight question? Here was a man who had had a crown of thorns thrust into his head, she said. Here was a man who was spat upon, stripped, beaten, whipped, and so disfigured he was unrecognizable. Does that look like a Lord to you? But this thief called him Lord because Jesus was still Lord on the cross. Chip's eyes fell. He didn't know quite why, but Gladys Blackburn's words made him aware of all the hatred and bitterness that had consumed him for years. For the first time, he caught a glimpse of a connection between Christ's death and himself. Christ was perfect, Chips thought. And I am full of evil, the sin he had to die for. He looked at the small woman. How do I become a Christian? He asked. And that night he committed his life to Jesus Christ. He'd seen the self-perpetuating emptiness of violence, the impotence of political philosophy. He realized he'd finally met the truth. Lord, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingly power. I find those very moving words. They are so full of hope, aren't they? Look at who's saying them. Here is one with absolutely nothing to trade in. There is no deal that he can strike with God. He doesn't have a past to offer. Well, he does, but it's that of a self-confessed, convicted criminal. And he certainly doesn't have a future to offer. He'll be dead any moment. You come here tonight thinking you're worthless? Well, you can say, Jesus, remember me, can't you? You can't have less to offer than this thief if you feel you're useless, soiled, discarded, whatever. I've got vividly stuck in my mind one evening I spent in one of the big banks across the way there. One of the dealers had asked to see me to talk about Christian things, and we were alone in the dealing room apart from the cleaner. He was the kind of guy who spoke very dramatically, and at one stage when we'd been talking a little bit about God, he turned to me and he said, "Hugh, I don't think you realize I'm an evil man." I said, "Well, the tremendous news is that my God specializes in evil men. You see, you can't have less to offer than this thief." What you might find harder to believe is that you actually don't have more to offer than this thief. If you've come thinking you're good enough for God, then Christ has nothing to offer you whatsoever. His cross might as well be empty. It's meaningless. But this criminal knew he had nothing to offer. He said, "Jesus, remember me." He throws himself on Jesus' mercy. They're words of utter dependence, aren't they? You can imagine the agonized pause after they've passed his lips. An agony compounded with waiting to hear what this king will say to him. "Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingly power." And Jesus said to him, "Truly, today, with me in paradise." They're all that's needed. They are all that's needed for you to meet God and rejoice in his paradise. Well, I've been hearing again this week one or two people say, "Well, I think I'm getting there. In the end, I will. One day I'll believe, I'm sure." I want to say I recognize the words. I've used them myself. I've used most of those kind of lines in my time. I tremble whenever I hear them. I confess that what goes through my mind now when someone says to me, "I'm sure one day I'll believe," I think immediately to myself, "Why are you so sure? What makes you so confident that one day you'll believe?" The impenitent thief only did what everyone else did, and he went to hell. We really don't need to do much to go to hell. Why am I so sure that one day I'll be ready to distance myself from my friends? That one day I will see myself for what I really am? That one day I'll declare my faith in this Jesus? I think I can only be confident if I make today that one day. If I'm saying I'll believe now. You say, "Just a second, I need to think about it." Well, you know, if you really do need to think about it. And if you do, then let me echo what John said earlier. Take up this yellow card. Yeah, do it. Why not? Let's have it in front of us. May mean we'll act. If you do need to think about it, then you need to fill this in. You don't need to think about that, because it's really offering you for a chance to think about the issues. That's what these evenings are designed to do. So have a look at which night suits you best and tick the relevant box. If none of them are any good, leave that bit blank. Fill in your name. If you're here with one of the school parties, then just put the name of your school in and we'll get in touch with someone who can give you help. Tear it off, as John said, and put it in the bin at the end. They'll be by the door. Look, if you came midweek and you took one of these home with you to think about it, don't take another one home. Well, why not only take half of it home? And if you're only going to take half home, we know what we printed on this side, and you presumably know what you'll have written on that side, and unless you need the address to get home, leave us the address and... Yeah, well... And there'll be others tonight who don't need to think. You've done all the thinking you need to do. You need to turn and say, "Jesus, remember me." It's not the greatest prayer ever written, is it? I don't know what Prince Charles would make of the language. But that's neither here nor there. It was effective. "Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingly power." And he said to him, "Truly, today, with me in paradise." How to die and go to heaven. We're all certain of the first half. Are you sure of paradise?
We're going to be quiet now.
I'm not going to pray, but I'm going to ask you to take this time to think. And there'll be some here tonight. It would be a big surprise if there weren't some here tonight who know perfectly well that what they need to do in this quiet is in the quiet to turn to Jesus and say, Jesus, remember me. Wouldn't today be a great day to be certain? Don't get into the habit of saying no to God. Habits are hard to break. When we've been quiet for a few moments, I've got one more thing to say. So let's be quiet. Let's think over these words. Don't you fear God? Jesus, remember me. Truly, today, with me, in paradise. If you're one of those who know you need to turn and say, remember me, to Jesus, maybe you've just done that in that silence. I have a little booklet here called Start a New Life. It'll put in a very few pages what we've been talking about tonight. I'll be at the far doors on the way out at the end. I've got a number of copies of this here. I'll be only too pleased to give it to you if you're at that kind of stage of your thinking. You'll find it, I think, a great help. You'll also find it a help to join in on one of these evenings if you can possibly make it and sort out what it is you've begun or you're realizing you need to start. So do ask me for one. Thank you for listening.